Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
All right, so this week in segment one, our feature story is about the five reasons organizations don't pursue big ideas. And in segment two, the Driving Eureka book excerpt is about meaningful uniqueness, what it is, and really how to evaluate whether you have it or not. And in the Brain Brew Whiskey segment, we will discuss the current state of the Brain Brew distillery and the vision of how you can craft your own whiskey using the Brain Brew system. So let's begin our first segment talking about the five reasons organizations don't pursue big ideas. Doug, you talk a little bit in this newsletter about the pullback in 2008 and that ideas had a tendency to get smaller as opposed to bigger, especially during that time period. You want to talk to that a little bit?
Yeah. So since the 90s, we've been measuring teams before we work with them. And whether it's teams coming to the Eureka Ranch to invent ideas, whether we're at their site, or whether it's educational programs. And we've been just tracking this index over time. And what you find is that courage to take action, optimism, really takes a hit when the stock market takes a hit. And I think sometimes it's just because when it goes down, they all get scared because what are they going to have for retirement because they didn't save enough or something. I'm not sure why it is, but it really does go. And in 08, it really went nuts. And that's when we really committed full bore to system-driven innovation. Before that, I used systems to invent ideas for companies. But we never really talked about it because nobody wanted to do it. They wanted a guru. They wanted Rent-A-Guru. But in 08, it changed, and people started to look for – they wanted systems. They wanted something more reliable. They wanted to grab onto something that was better. But despite that, what they did is they tended to, like you would do if you faced fear, is they tended to circle the wagons and get more and more conservative, thinking if we just do something small, maybe that'll work. And the problem with that is that when you do that, when you do the small stuff, you do stuff that isn't worth doing. And so your failure rates skyrocket and it makes it even worse. And so, you know, it really happened. And what I found is, you know, recently, as I've mentioned, I stepped down as CEO of the Eureka Ranch, which I've been running for many, many years since I founded it. And Maggie Nichols is now the president and CEO, and I'm chairman. And then my other role is sort of a corporate governance role, basically not do anything except, you know, keep an eye on things, I guess, and hold meetings and have fun with board members. Much more fun to be the chairman with the board members than it is to be the CEO with the board members. It's just a thing, just saying. But I also took on another role, which is really cool, which is I'm chief inventor. And you've seen this with a lot of the tech companies where the founder goes on to do R&D or to work the tech stuff. And in my case, it's inventor. So I go to projects, and my role at the projects is not to lead it, not to manage the clients, not to help them through their things, but to just be an idea machine, just coming up with ideas. And so it's glorious. And it's interesting. If I'd have known this was this much fun, I would have done it sooner. because it is just so much more fun when you can just think. You get to think. And it's just been a ton of fun. And I talk about this in this feature article from the Driving Eureka newsletter. And it's a whole different world. And it's like I'm almost thinking like companies need to have somebody that just thinks, a thinker, because we so sub-optimized based on all of the stuff, all of the politics and the regulatory and the junk that we don't think enough is something that I think goes on.
You know, it's interesting because I've heard you talk about this before, and then watching you during the course of some of the classes, you are constantly challenging for bigger ideas, and that's where I got the nickname "the prudent one." So, you know, is that kind of the role then that you're playing now, is to make sure that the people are thinking big enough and pushing them to new levels? Is that kind of this new role? Is that kind of where you're going?
Yeah, it's some of that. It's one part with Chick Thompson, who writes on creativity, who's a good friend. He says a balloon expanded never goes back to its same dimensions. So part of my job is to expand the sphere that they're looking at so that they're looking at something much bigger than they would normally do. And by stretching them out, because it's easier to tame down than it is to build up.
Hmm.
Okay, much easier to do that. The second role that I think I am playing here, and this is still developing as we get into it, is, you know, they say that some of the old ball players, whether it's hockey or sports or basketball, baseball, football, whatever it is, some of the older ones, they get good at trickery and guile. You know, they've had enough experiences that they can find clever ways around things. And I find myself oftentimes sitting in when we're inventing ideas and they say, we can't do that. And I go, oh, hell, I know a way to get around that corporate problem. That's not a big deal. You can kind of do this end run and you can do this. And so, you know, when you've done 26,000 or something like that, they counted up, ideas created and tested, you either get fairly decent at it or you go crazy. And I'm not sure which has exactly happened, but
maybe both.
But it's a ton of fun. And so there is a value to this, and staying full contact engaged. And it's interesting because it's actually, I am more exhausted at the end of the day thinking of ideas than I am doing the, you know, client management handling. I mean, that's tiring from an emotional standpoint, but the brain cells you have to do to really think hard about how do you transform an industry and how do you flip it and how do you do something that's amazing, that's going to send people into excitement. It really burns you out. It burns you out. But at the end of the day, I'm all fine. I just have a glass of our whiskey, and it's all good.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I know. Well, that always helps. It's an interesting thing. I'm reading these books on neuroscience, and one of the things that comes out is as we age, that supposedly, you know, the neurons stop and the brain cells disappear and all those types of things. But the types of things that you are talking about actually increase the neuron, you know, and the synapses, you know, firing and everything in the brain. And so you may be increasing your life, Doug, by doing that. Seriously. I mean, it's amazing.
I'll have the booze and then I'll
grow. Okay. You fire the neurons, then kill them. And okay, I get it.
Okay. By the way, that's a trade off. I can work with that.
You can live with that. Okay. Well, it's the unfortunate thing is we're old enough now where you can basically try whiskey and do things like that and know that that's a good thing and makes you feel good. And then also now you have this added benefit of firing the neurons to come up with bigger ideas or challenge people to. And I think that's probably the thing that wears you out, Doug, is, you know, you arm wrestled my class anyway and trying to get people to think bigger. I mean, it was, I think I saw more of an emotional toll taken on the class in that fashion than probably you just coming up with ideas. You know, there is one story that might be that I'd almost think fits here. You talked about at one company, can't remember the company and maybe can't say, but where you had the best idea, it was voted the best idea and one that was the worst idea.
Yeah, I that's Johnson & Johnson, actually.
Okay.
I hold that record at a lot of places. we and I'm proud of both, because what happens is when it comes to meaningfully unique ideas, they're going to change the world, that are going to make a difference. I mean, let's face it, most of the ideas are just too small to matter. They just don't matter. People don't change for the sake of just changing to you. You got to be a lot better. But when you push the edges, when you really push the new and different, sometimes you can be, you know, ahead of your time, and it can be really good or really bad, you know, because really unique can go both ways. And But the key is to have the courage to do something that's never been done before, to really stress and push the system. And that's the key. And interestingly, Tripp, as I've been doing this, I started to observe the people around me. Now, recognize my goal is I'm not leading the project, so I don't have to get them there. I'm there to just put it out there. If they're not going to, you know, I can take the horse to water, but I don't have to make him drink. That's not my job. I'm not managing anymore. It's way better. It's way more fun. You know, I don't have grandkids, but I guess it's the same. You get to play with them and then they go home. You know, it's the same thing here. I just get to think amazing thoughts and really, you know, push myself to reinvent it. But as I've been doing it, I've been observing, as I've been talking to executives about, why don't you do something outrageous? You know, and we're sitting there. And, you know, we got a crazy whiskey company where we make whiskey in 40 minutes in a time machine. And so we're sitting there having some, and they're like, how do you do this? How do you do this? And so I made a list. And let's just go through them real quick.
Yeah, sure. The five things.
I made a list that I put in the newsletter, the five top reasons I'm hearing and feeling that people aren't doing big ideas that holds them back. And the first one is the success standards are just too low. I think most corporations' standards for what is a go idea are too low by about two standard deviations. I mean, it's just too low. What used to be okay in the 80s and 90s, in today's world, you've got to be a lot more unique for anybody to give a darn about you. I mean, you just can't have those hair splitting differences anymore.
Is that a cause, Doug? I'm sorry. Just interjecting. Is that because there's so much noise out there now with new products and ideas, or what's the reason for that?
That's right. That's right. There's so much more stuff. So many more things are happening. To break through the clutter, you have to do something much more significant, much more significant than you do it. But the standards haven't changed for two reasons. One is because the people setting the standards aren't resetting them. They're not thinking about this. The standard is the standard is the standard. I got one Fortune 20 company. It is a joke. They said all of our ideas meet our test standards and not working. And I said, duh. You haven't changed your test standards in 30 freaking years. You know, it's not the same. It's not the same. It's changed. You got to push bigger. You know, go big or go home if you want to break through the clutter. The other reason they don't do it, and I find this at companies because I go into companies or the Eureka Ranch, not me anymore, it's been Maggie and the team. They go into companies, and when they're sitting with companies to go through stuff, and we would run and take their existing pipeline and test the ideas, and under our standards, which are much more market-facing, much more aware, most of the projects aren't worth doing. And they go, well, we got nothing else. And I go, well, they're going to fail. And they go, yeah, probably, but I got to do something because it's in my KPIs for the month. So I have, you know, and so you're working on stuff that you don't care about. So first off is success standards.
Okay.
The second is they don't trust their development system. So they look at an idea, and this is where, as I joke with you, practical, prudent, and puckered. They look at an idea and they go, well, our team can't do that. So let's back off on it. Let's back off. And so they sub optimize their ideas before they even begin. They just do it. They're setting them down at a lower level. So they're getting what their expectations were, which are just not reasonable. I tell teams, if you already know how to do the idea, why the hell didn't you do it last year? I mean, this is ridiculous. Development means we've got to discover the excitement of innovation. I mean, if you want to drive Eureka, you've got to be pushing yourself to discover new things, to find new answers, to find new ways of doing things. I mean, just before I did this, we have a partner down in South Africa we're talking to who wants to take our whiskey aging process and apply it to brandy. And so just before this, I had an opportunity. Well, somebody has to do the job. I had to sit and taste a whole collection of luxury brandies that we're making.
So this interview could be a lot more interesting than what I originally planned, is what you're telling me.
Well, at least for me it is.
Okay.
We spit out after.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, but in tasting this stuff, we don't know anything about how brandy works with us. This is our first time tasting it. It didn't act the way we expected it to. It went into new things. And it immediately opened up our brains to new ideas.
Mm.
That's what we need to do, is we need to push people to do stuff. Okay, so that's number two. Number three, the aim of the system is to control, not enable. I think fundamentally, most innovation systems have been put in because somebody had a failure, and they've been put in to prevent failure at all costs. And they do that because they prevent any idea at all cost. And so not only are we playing it safe, but we're designing the system to prevent bold ideas from getting through. Number four, we have no ability to fail fast and fail cheap in development. In other words, it is command and control all the way through. And the feedback loops, you know, I was in Philadelphia and I gave a talk to a big organization. And I was talking to one of the product developers. This lady is a big dog at this company, big multinational company. I said, how long does it take you to do a paired comparison test? So say you're working on a product and you want to make sure that this product beats this other product. And you want to do a paired comparison test, performance test. I said, how long does it take? Oh, she says about 3 months. I said, 3 months? She says, yeah, it's 3 months. It's a long process. And I go, how do you get any work done? How do you do anything bold? I said, that means you got 4 cycles a year. She says, no, I got like 2 cycles. Because then after the report, I have to do a whole bunch of meetings about it and then get ready to start it again. I said, that's ridiculous. She said, well, what's your cycle time on the whiskey business? I said, well, 24 hours. She said, well, that's ridiculous. I said, what's ridiculous? She says, it's ridiculous that you get to do it in 24 hours and it takes me forever. That's not fair.
So they're not able to fill fast, fill cheap, just because of their own bureaucracy, then, in essence. That's what's slowing them down. They have to fill reports, right, and go to meetings and report.
And the processes are too slow and the systems are too slow. And then the last thing is there's no pride of work. You know, the ability for people to be passionate about stuff. We've got analysis paralysis that defines subsegments of segments. And this thing that, in theory, in their spreadsheets, my guys in the labs like to talk about spreadsheet people. But where they're doing the spreadsheet to predict this thing, and there's no heart and soul in it. And as I said, you know, last week, you got to love it. You got to love it. And if you don't love it. So the top five reasons: standards are too low, don't trust our development, so we play it safe. The aim of our system is to control, not enable. We have no ability to fail fast, fail cheap, and there's no pride of work.
Okay.
What I'm learning.
Okay. And is there one that really stands out more than the other, or they kind of have equal weight?
Pretty much in the order that I said them.
Okay.
I
mean, so that is.
It starts with the standards. It really does start with the standards. What happens is if I go from an okay score to a great score, something that's really meaningfully unique, you have to cause a lot more disruption. You have to be doing stuff that's really different. And people are scared. I just did a call today where somebody said, well, you know, when we're creating ideas, should we review our manufacturing capabilities and what we can make? And I said, no. They said, why? Because I said, I don't care. They said, well, but we want to make sure that we can make it. I said, what you can make is what you make now. Aren't we supposed to be creating something new? And the lady said, well, but what if we can't make it? She says, we can't afford to put in new equipment. I said, okay, let's go on. If it does $1 billion in sales, could you afford new equipment? She says, well, yes, obviously. I said, if it did $900 million in sales, could you? Oh, yes, sure. She says, I get your point. I said, the fact that you have to put in new equipment is irrelevant to this conversation. It's irrelevant. What's important to say is, can we come up with an idea that can make a meaningful difference in our customers' lives? Then we look at the death threat of what's it going to cost to do it, and we figure that out.
Yes.
It's a different mindset.
Yeah. No, that provides a lot of clarity. That's very cool. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book excerpt with legendary inventor Doug Hall. Well, let's go to the next segment, which is the book excerpt, if I can say that. And you're talking about, we touched on it in some of our previous conversations, but the operational definition of meaningfully unique and that coming out of the book, Driving Eureka. Let's just dig into that. And you've maybe provide us a little bit of history on what meaningfully unique is.
So we did a pile of research, a couple PhDs, a statistician and I, because we had the value of a whole pile of ideas that we had the original scores on how customers perceived they would like them and then what really happened in the marketplace. And so with that, you can start to model these things and you start to see what's most predictive. And classically, people will ask, you know, the very simple, what seems like the simple question, which is how likely are you to buy it? And definitely would buy, probably would buy, et cetera. And what we found is that that was an okay measure. But when we did the modeling on it, the best predictor was asking them how likely they were to buy it, as well as asking them how new and different it was. And there were some scale differences. We used the Juster probability scale, 0 to 10, instead of probably would buy scale, and some other technical details, which also matter. And then you weight them 60% towards the purchase and 40% to the new and different. And that is far more predictive of not only trial, but repeat, word of mouth awareness, distribution. I mean, it's a chain reaction of positives. And you quite simply, I mean, we later found, we took that back around to a Harvard Business Review article that said you actually, when you have high purchase and new and different, you have like a 5x greater chance of profitable success. So it really is. It's meaningfulness. It has value to the customer. They get it. And it's unique. It's an original. It's not been done before. Another way to think about it is, are customers willing to pay more money for it? Because if customers don't spend more money just for the hell of it, they only spend more money when they feel like they're getting something that's of value to them that they can't get elsewhere. And, you know, companies will tell me, we're very unique. We're very innovative. I said, okay, so what's your margin versus your competition? Oh, heck, you know, it's terrible. We have to fight on price. I said, so you're a commodity. Hmm. It's the basic definition of a commodity. And people hate that. They're you're not being very nice. I said, I'm not being – that's not me. You made the decision to sell the same old crap as everybody else. They go, well, no, we got this difference and this difference. And I go, you know, this is a hair. Here's a split hair. You know, forget it. You got nothing. And so you got to really push it.
Wow. The things that you get out of doing this type of research, you mentioned in here that you get word of mouth. You get, you know, you just actually – gave it when you were saying you were testing some things for the brandy, you're, you know, sparking other ideas as you're testing. And that must be one of the benefits of kind of going through the research process anyway, and also patentable ideas too. And these are the results then, right?
Yeah, they're the results. And they also help you. They're another way for you to derive that the thing really is meaningfully unique. Okay, so I've got a quantitative way that we validated. Dr. Lynn Colley and I in the Journal of Consumer Marketing wrote an article. It's one of the most cited business articles of all time on this research. But we've also, you know, qualitatively, will they pay more money? When you hear the idea, does it spark a bunch of other ideas? You know, because big ideas do that. Because they immediately open up our minds to, like, it's like we've opened up a door to a whole new world and we're seeing things for the first time. And is it patentable? Because patents are a clear measure that you have something that's not been done before. Because the definition of a patent is it's non-obvious to somebody with ordinary skill in the art. Or said the other way, if your idea is obvious to somebody with ordinary skill.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't sound like that's very innovative.
Right.
You know, it's got to be a leap. It's got to be a disruptive leap.
Well, and I think that's, you know, one of the problems. It kind of creates fear. You know, all throughout my life, and I know a lot of people like this because you have a tendency, you know, once you go to your class to discuss with this with other people, is you think you've got this great idea, and then all of a sudden you ask your wife or your best friend or somebody like that, and they're like, that's not a good idea, and so you just kind of give it up. Is that pretty prevalent, and how do you mitigate that kind of self-doubt portion that people have? Is that in essence the process, or are ideas just dumb on the surface anyway?
I'm trying. It's a great question. I'm really thinking to try to give. I've got a lot of flippant answers.
You can kill me. No, you can say, Trip, all your ideas are dumb. Everybody else has got something. I'm okay with that too.
I'm trying to honor it and to really answer it, because for me it's so foreign. But I've got bad breeding or something. I mean, it came from my grandmother, and our second daughter's got the exact same bad genes. Because if somebody says you can't do it, it just gets me more excited. Because one of the fundamental definitions of a patent is it's not obvious. And so if an expert tells me it can't be done, I go, could be patentable. Could be patentable. Then this is sick, by the way. This is a sickness. Because I just get more excited. In other words, why is it that when I hear you can't do it, I just get more excited, and normal people hear I can't do it, and I go, okay, that's right, I'll not do that. I'm going to stop. I mean, I don't know. Part of it is I guess I've done it so many times, and I also have systems and teams, and I've got teams of people around me. My wife calls them enablers. She says, stop enabling him. Because some of my ideas are most are bad, but I find it out pretty quickly. And so I guess if it's worthy and mission focused, if it's going to make a difference that I think that matters, I don't really give a damn what people say. I mean, you know, I just don't care. And that's probably not a reasonable answer.
Well, I think it's a reasonable answer. I think the portion is maybe a better question to ask would be how is driving Eureka going to get me out of that mode? You know, what's in here that's going to take me? You've got this meaningfully unique component, but if that's my mindset, and you admittedly said you're the unique one, when it comes to new ideas, how do you get those people, because that's really your challenge, right? I mean, that's what kind of being the chief inventor is, getting those people out of that kind of mindset of, self-doubt about what may be a good idea, maybe not, or could spark other ideas. What's the magic?
Yeah. Well, so let's take, I think it's in levels. By the way, that was a really cheesy way to put the book back in, by the way. I think that was good. That was awesome, by the way. That was really good. But it is a good question, and maybe that's the reason why this book took 9 years to write.
And probably 10 to read, right?
I wrote it 3 times. It took 9 years to write the damn thing. Because my publisher pushed me. This book is actually less words than any other book I've done of the business books. And by the way, that's a lot harder to do. With fewer words and still say something important, not write a puff piece. I think if the first 150 pages, the first of the book, really start to lay out the system to do it. And so I think there's levels. I think there's the people who think they can't do it at all, which is the majority of the population. And they have no idea how to do this. And they don't even know that there are tricks. You know, we're not geniuses. I mean, I made the top half of my chemical engineering class possible. I graduated at 2 point something, okay? But the difference was I approach things as a system, and I've got systems for doing it. I don't just try to make it up each time as a one-off thing. There are methods, reproducible lessons and laws that when you do them, it allows you to create ideas. It allows you to be more persuasive. It allows you to find death threats. But if you've never been taught that, which is the way it is with most people, they've never been taught, unless you've had one of our innovation engineering courses on campuses, on the college campuses and universities, then you never knew it. You never knew it. And so I think the first level is you can take the people that don't think they can do it, and you can make them functional. And that's what our fundamentals course, which is basically what's in this book, that gets you to that fundamentals. Those first 150 pages are basically the fundamentals of doing it. Now, the back half of the book is advanced, which is the mastery level, which is, you know, it's a black belt thing. And then you get a, you know, undergraduate minor or a graduate certificate for it. But that advanced course is at a different level. So I think, you know, let's divide it in, and there's four levels. There's the people who don't think they can do it. There's the fundamentals, which we can make you functional. And that we can get everybody to be able to do it. There's the mastery level where you really get to do it. And then there's this level that happens after thousands and thousands of hours of doing it that takes you to another space. And there are people like that. Dave Buck was one of those guys that did that. And I've known and John Ruffley was one of those guys. And I've met people over the years who have got that ability, but they've been doing it for so long, they can just quickly come up with ideas. Because they've just got so much experience, and so they're the abnormal ones, which I am now in that group probably.
Okay, so basically, Driving Eureka is going to give people more like me, I guess, would probably be the prudent ones, a method to help them get more comfortable. Then
that's right, and it's going to get you from denying it to being comfortable with it, you know, and then what you'll find is that after you do it, because we know. Building unshakable belief, which is a key concept we'll be talking about in some future episodes. This concept of unshakable belief, you can only get it by applying it. And by the way, reading the book won't make it happen for you. What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to apply it to your life. You're going to have to take one of the things and try it. And if you want help with that, we have a video workbook where you read the chapter like a book club. You read the chapter, and then you watch a short video, and then you have an assignment of something to do, an action to do, because that's where the real learning happens. And you can find out about that on the websites, and there's different information on it. And that's something you can work with Maggie. Make a note to put in a direct link to the video workbook.
Video workbook.
That people can get
okay.
To.
We'll do that. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we're going to take you behind the scenes on what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company like has never been done before. Doug, one of the knocks on people who give advice or consultants is that they don't practice what they preach. And so you've built this whiskey business, and we covered off a little bit of it in our first newsletter talking about the purpose and the distillery itself. But this concept that you have talked about that really intrigues me, and I at least want to have some initial conversations about is this whole concept of craft whiskey and getting people to kind of brand their own thing. Where are you in that process? How does that happen? I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding if you got an individual out there and they're interested, let's say, in their own craft whiskey for a wedding. You mentioned that in our previous episode or whatever. How you taking them through? At least give me a few notes here. You may have, I think you said okay. You're still working on it.
Yeah, we're very close. So where we are with the whiskey business right now is we have our federal permit with the TTB from the federal government. We are about a week from our state of Ohio permit. And in the absence of those, we've been doing production over in Kentucky at another distillery using their permit, file the paperwork so that we can do products under there. So we were manufacturing it there. You have to have a licensed location for it. So that's been able to get us up and running as we're doing it. And so we've been doing a lot of research on figuring out how to do it. And it's built around some simple things. Let me go back in time for a little bit first. Prior to Prohibition, when alcohol was made illegal across the U.S., everybody had their own whiskey. There were 70 distilleries in Cincinnati alone. And that doesn't count all of the blenders who would take whiskeys from those 70 and make their own. And literally every restaurant, every bar, every individual would have their own personal blend of whiskey with grains and whatever they wanted in it. And it was very common. After Prohibition, there were just a few companies that got permits during Prohibition to do medicinal alcohol. And so they were able to keep spirit in barrels and had product when Prohibition ended, and they pretty much took over the market and did it. And the Canadians came down, and Cutty Sark came in from Scotland, and the little guys were basically gone by that point. What my vision is when I make a whiskey, like our Relativity product, that's one that I crafted, and I take that product and I serve it to people, it is such a cool thing to tell them the story of why I used the grains I did, why I used the compression I did, what I was trying to do. It's just, it's awesome. Okay. It's like a piece of art, but that you get to drink, you know, which makes it even better. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if everybody could do that exact same thing and to go through that? And our line is basically Brain Brew Custom Whiskey, because everybody deserves their own whiskey. Now, how does it work? When you work with whiskey, as I've said before, there are tribes. We don't have any tribes. We're just about grain spirits and how they could work. They're typically made, the four big grains are corn, wheat, rye, and barley. Corn is obviously the predominant grain in bourbon. Wheat whiskeys are very popular. They're very small, but they can be very luxury. And wheat is oftentimes put in the highest end bourbons. They'll use wheat will be the second ingredient after corn. Rye is the big spicy one. It's kind of the IPA of whiskeys. It's brasher. Okay. It's usually higher alcohol. And barley is the product of Scotland. That's what they use in Scotland. Single malt barley is what they use. And so it's kind of a Scottish. So corn is bourbon. Barley is Scottish. Rye is growing. They typically were Canadian. And wheat is the underappreciated one, which is a magnificent grain, but it's hard to work with. It's hard to work with, but it is magnificent when you make it right. It really creates an elegance to it, I think, in my mind. And so we can take those products, and because of our time compression technology, where all we do, it's 100% natural, all we do is we take the spirit and we put pieces of wood in that we've charred and things, staves or whatever pieces that we want to do. And then we take it through heating and cooling cycles, just like the barrels go through. Just like Woodford Reserve in the wintertime, they heat their warehouses and then they cool them. They heat them and they cool them. It's no different, than what we're doing. We just happen to be doing it with very, very high precision, super reduction of variance in the process is what we do. And so we're able to make amazing whiskey in about 40 minutes. We can mimic what the seasons of barrel aging are like in the old world, which would be Scotland. We can mimic what's it like to do it in the U.S., where it's a general rule, at least through this swathe of the Ohio River Valley, Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, it's obviously a lot warmer than it is in northern Scotland. And so what people do is they come to an artisan whiskey experience where they taste the deconstructed whiskeys. So corn, wheat, rye, and barley. They'll taste it first New World style, then they taste it Old World style, and they're shocked because they usually you go to a bourbon tasting or a scotch tasting, you never get them together. And so they get to taste them. And then the last set are predominantly corn, wheat, rye, and barley, but now done in a more craft style. And the new craft styles are much more creative and different. You know, it might be multiple woods, could be different things in it. And then we give them a pipette, and they literally take a graduated cylinder and they start to make their own blend. So they've rated them individually. Now they put together their own and they go through some fun experiences and some food and different stuff. And then at the end of that, they give us their recipe and we make it for them and they get it the next day.
That's unbelievable.
So this is whiskey and you can do, and we have them sign the bottle, Artisan Whiskey Experience by them. If they want, they can get fancy labels printed, but fundamentally, this is less about a label and more about the product. And they can get their own personal taste. And the looks on their faces are amazing. I mean, it's just the coolest experience to make your own bottle. I mean, whiskey has a place in society that is different than beer, different than wine. I mean, it is that ultimate end of the night, beautiful taste. There's something magnificent about it.
So they're really just trying different things to find out what maybe their real taste is, and then you find the right mixture for them, and in essence...
They'll put it together.
Okay.
And we've got some artificial intelligence things that will give them some recommendations, and we give them coaching on how to put it together. But here's the amazing thing. So they put it together and make their own taste. This is their taste buds. I don't know their taste buds. They're going to do their own. But every time we do it, we keep getting more and more data. So eventually we'll be able to also give them a computerized recommendation, and then they'll make it themselves. But what's interesting about it is all the ones they like, and we tell them this, they'll say, oh, I like these three. I like Old World barley. I like New World corn and rye. And then they put those together and they go, that tastes terrible. I go, it's the interaction. It's a system. It's an interaction of the parts, as Dr. Deming would say. And it doesn't work. And I said, now you got to start to think about it like a musical note. What's the high note, the middle notes, the bass notes? What are you trying to do? And they start to get into it, and people just, their minds go, because at the beginning they thought, I'm never going to be able to tell the difference in the whiskeys. I can't tell the difference. Well, I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, these 12 whiskeys are all distinctly different. It's not like sometimes, you know, you get a scotch, you get bourbon, you taste five of them, they all taste the same. No, these are, by design, 12 unique tastes. Wow. You will like them, hate them. You'll rarely be neutral to them. But when you put them together, you're going to want to put, like we've got a smoked product, number 12. You might want to have 5% smoke in there because it gives it a backbone that's kind of nice. Or you want to keep the light wheat in it because you want the freshness and the lightness to it. And by the time you get done, people say, well, isn't it scotch about heritage? I go, yeah, that's what it is today. But you know what it is now? You're making your heritage when you're crafting your own product.
That's pretty cool.
The other thing this does for us is it enables distilleries to start to craft products just like it was pre-prohibition. And eventually every bar, every restaurant, every hotel is going to have their own whiskey. You're not going to have Jimmy and Johnny's, you know, Johnny Walker and Jimmy Beans. That was nice. I want mine. I want my own whiskey. And so that to me is the future. And to me, what delights me about this is, one, the wow for the customer to be able to get their own thing and finding that there are whiskeys that they like and it's magnificent. That's just fun. I mean, that's just the culinary aspect of serving that. The other part that gets me excited is we're going to enable folks that are making maybe vodka and gin to be able to do world-class, because we win double gold medals at competitions in Los Angeles and all that stuff. And we're going to enable those people to have their own whiskey, to do whiskeys and to do custom whiskeys for people. And so we're going to help those entrepreneurs make more money. And in the process, they're going to discover things. We've already got a rye that's coming out that was discovered because of some work people were doing messing with the rye. And we're going to find other new ideas as people do this. As we look at not the individuals, but we start to look at the patterns and we put it in an artificial intelligence computer and we start to look at what are some of the roots and the patterns that people are doing? Not one person, but hundreds and hundreds of people. As that data builds up, it's going to help us discover new things and new tastes.
So who are you looking for now? Are these just people that want their own brand, or is these for people who are reselling? Is it a combination of them? Or are you just kind of messing around at this point to see what you come up with?
We're setting up in Cincinnati. We'll be running it here. And then we're in conversations with people in a bunch of different countries and across the U.S. Where we're going to set up some beta sites doing custom whiskey. And we're going to license them and enable them with the technology to get going. And obviously, if they're a distiller, they've already got the permits. But if they don't have a permit, they can go through the process to become a blender. And they can go into whiskey. So rather than spending millions and millions of dollars for a fraction of that, you're going to be able to go into the whiskey business. And we're going to announce that program in February. We're going to the Craft Spirits Conference. We've got booth space up there in Minneapolis in February. And we're going to make it so that anybody that wants to go into the whiskey business, you can.
That's so cool.
It's easy.
All right.
It's easy.
That's amazing. I'm fascinated by the whole what the capabilities are. And what's interesting to me, and we really haven't talked about it in the episodes that we've had so far, is, you know, you talk a lot about diversity, and you're actually bullied in by virtue of having these crafted whiskeys, these customized whiskeys, and you're getting other insights into what could be made. Yeah, that's a very interesting.
Yeah, and the future, I think, is all, you know, there will always be a place for the great brands. I love Macallan. I love Highland Park. I mean, before they were even partners with us, I was asked somebody, what's your favorite whiskey? I said Highland Park and then Macallan. And I love them and I drink them. And they're tremendous and they're wonderful products. And I love some of the great bourbons as well. But I also really like to have my own. And I really like to, when I travel, I like to go to local places. And this local thing, there's going to be a percentage of the market that's going to go to that. And I just think it's wonderful to be able to enable that local energy and creativity. Because with our stuff, you can use amazing wood. So when I was tasting just recently, when I was tasting the brandies, a fella had come to us and he had done, it's really amazing, a bunch of them had never done this before, but they bought a piece of land and they developed it with houses. They did all the development. I'm like, you guys got to be crazy. They said, well, it seemed like an easy thing to do. I said, I know, I've gotten into those things before. And they did this. And as it turned out, there was an old building on it that they saved that had oak boards in it. And so he got a board and he said, would you try making whiskey with it to see what it comes out with? And I just tasted it and it's pretty amazing.
That's awesome.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, that's that's outside the box there. Okay. Well, let's talk about in this kind of fun section, your craft cocktail recipe, the Crazy Viking. What is that?
Yeah, so this is one that actually was last Thanksgiving that this came up. I bought a bunch of stuff that I'd never seen before, and there was this product called Linny, which is a Nordic spirit. It's an aquavit, and that is a it's a very unique taste to it. And so I was just playing with different things, and I made this sort of a riff on a Negroni. Now, it's really not a riff on Negroni because Negroni uses gin and I'm using bourbon, and he uses Campari and I'm using aquavit. The only thing that's the same is that it has sweet vermouth in it. So it's not even close to that. But it basically, it's to a rocks glass full of ice. And again, this is in the show notes so that you can get it. Put an ounce of bourbon, and I prefer our Noble Oak bourbon, which if you go to NobleOak.com, you can find it. It's about half the country right now. And then 1 ounce of Linny Aquavit. And you get this complex, creative concoction is the best way I can describe it. And I don't know if it's the Norwegian aspect of the aquavit, but I particularly like it outside when it's bracing cold. I don't know. There's just something about it. It's like that. And when you see the picture of it in the show notes, I put it outside on the rocks because it's got a robustness to it. It's got an edginess to it. It reminds me a lot of, I've been to Orkney, the island of Orkney, which is north of Scotland. My mom's family came from Thurso, Scotland, which is on the North Shore, and Highland Park is made there, which is the brother to the Macallan. And it's made on the island of Orkney. It's the northernmost distillery in the world. And Highland Park has some cocktails that have this same, that it tends to have a peatedness to it, and it's a ruggedness to it, and it's definitely not a wussy drink, you know. But it's not harsh. It's not bite your face off. It's just hearty, They Highland Park, they oftentimes talk about Vikings. It's got that Vikingness to it. Well, this crazy Viking has that same spirit, which is why I gave it the name Viking, because it was in memory of Highland Park. It's just a unique taste, and I think as we go into the wintertime, I think some folks should have some, although I drank them this summer on the beach too, but especially late at night, it's particularly good. So it's a crazy Viking, bourbon, sweet vermouth. I use Dolan is what I usually use, and Linney Aquavit, an ounce of each. Go to the liquor store. The Linney, you'll find it. It'll be dusty because nobody buys it. And after you get it, you're going to just love it. You'll only use it for this one cocktail, but you'll amaze your friends. People say they love a Manhattan. You give them this, and they go, man, that's got a lot more complexity than a Manhattan, which would basically be the bourbon and the vermouth. This has got a lot more complexity. If you like Manhattans, you're going to love this. You're going to love it.
Very cool. And you said that Noble Oak is available in about half the country right now?
Yeah, okay. Pretty much from a population standpoint. 17 states, but those states include New York and California and Texas. So, you know, proportionally it's...
I got you. Population-wise, it's greater.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. Well, this has been really interesting as far as learned a lot from your experience in working with different organizations and how they beat down big ideas and make them smaller. That's certainly a concept that... I can relate to. And then also, you know, getting a little bit more understanding of meaningfully unique, and not only where it came from, but how it's applied. And then, of course, the third segment, we basically talked about not only the crazy Viking drink, but how you're going to be customizing whiskey for entrepreneurs to be able to kind of sell their own brand or for other things that you've mentioned before, weddings and things of that sort.
Oh, people go crazy for weddings. And just to preview coming attractions in the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy next week, I'm going to tell you the one thing you need to have to create a distillery. The one thing you have to have. That's coming up next week on the Driving Eureka podcast, as well as in the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing about that next week. Thank you for listening. Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time four things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.